It's 10 o'clock, so hopefully everyone has a good morning. Arrived at South by Southwest successfully. Hopefully this is the right session. Better get them to shoot your eye out with. My name's David Kuntz, and let's get started. So this is who I am. I'm a guy who's been interested in game development for a long time, co-chair of the Phoenix IGDA, teach game development, have a degree in game development, whatever that means. It's sort of one of those silly, you can get a key degree in game development. So I did. Sounded like fun. And I'm here to talk to you about building better guns. So this is an interactive session. We're part of interactive here. So ask questions at any time. I don't mind being interrupted. I'm used to it. Just if you have a question about something, anything's unclear, ask the question. Either snag that mic, pass around, whatever, or just yell it out and I'll repeat it. But please do not sit there going, I kind of think I know what he's talking about, but I'm not really sure. Yell out your question, because someone else probably has the exact same question. And there's no rule number two. Yell out your questions. So, first off, I'd like to quick survey. Who here does or would like to do game development or messes around with game development, kind of? Like, that's like the primary interest for coming is sort of some game development related thing. Okay. And who programs in like a C, C++, Java? Primarily. That's the language you use for your game development. What about, does anyone use like a crazy people? They use like Python, Perl, Ruby, whatever for, okay, got the Ruby sure now. Okay, so mostly the C, C++ probably camp, maybe a little Java, C# here and there with like XNA or something. So I think we can all agree no matter what language we're using, game development is difficult. One of the harder disciplines within software engineering, there's a lot of stuff going on. If anyone doesn't think it's difficult, then my hat is off to you, or you're crazy. So, game development is difficult because it's kind of a special kind of software engineering. It has sort of special requirements, special needs that are a little more stringent than the rest of the software engineering world. The biggest problem, perhaps, is that there's a ton of moving parts. There's lots of things that can go wrong at any given point. You've got your AI system, you've got your graphics, you've got your network traffic if you're doing some sort of multiplayer game, you've got user input, you've got different kinds of user input, joysticks and keyboards and mice and all sorts of things. And I a lot of times feel that I'm building a Rube Goldberg machine at some point. You've got all these little pieces and it's like, couldn't this just be easier? Why do we have so many little things all over the place? And of course, games development is very much focused on speed. That's really what has been sort of the driving thing behind the evolution of games over the last 20, 30 years is getting them to run faster, more polygons, higher resolution textures, more pixel shaders, speed. And when we say speed, we're mainly talking graphical speed. That's where most of our speed goes to, is graphics. Okay, so these limitations, or not limitations, but these constraints mean that we're going to probably implement our game in C or C++, probably, most of the time. And that implementation is going to be very focused. And the focus is going to be execution efficiency. We have to run fast. You can't just, you know, add another game console if it runs too slow. You can't like scale out horizontally like you can in a hosted, like a web app type solution. You have one box and it's got to run on that one box. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. So most implementations not very friendly to things that are not optimizable, things that you can't do at compile time, things that you cannot sort of optimize away or compile away. So that is an interesting set of constraints, one that I don't think exists in too many other places, maybe like embedded development, that kind of thing. But it's one that means that this ecosystem becomes very closed. I don't know if anyone here is actually a professional game developer. I know many. I chose not to go down that path myself because of the working conditions in the industry, but The ecosystem is such that the people that you know and the people you talk to all do sort of the same kind of thing that you do, and it's all game engines and C++ focused on speed, execution efficiency. So that becomes a very closed ecosystem. So, world of game graphics zips along super fast, new stuff all the time. Awesome. Cutting edge. The world of game design or game development software methodologies, on the other hand, not the most cutting edge, not the most recent. Okay, so some ideas, just to illustrate, some ideas that you could walk into an average game studio and ask them are, so how do you do your unit testing? To which you'd probably receive a blank stare, saying, either what's unit testing or how the hell would you test a game? Like, you'd have to like have a box sitting there all the time with a DirectX 10 compatible card to run your tests. And even then it would be horribly difficult to wire up this test rig and, oh, I didn't want to think about it. It's hard enough just to get the game to run, right? So unit testing, probably out. Test-driven design or behavior-driven design, have you ever heard of that? Unthinkable. Just don't even go there. Things like a continuous integration build box, that one maybe might have done something like that just to make sure everything compiles properly when people check in code, but not what I would consider to be the norm. So our job in building a better gun is to realize there can be a better gun. So we have to say, this is not acceptable. We can do better. Okay. So first job, we're gonna start with the premise, false perhaps, but we're gonna start with the premise that we can build a better gun. And this increasingly becomes important as our projects get bigger and bigger, because C is not exactly a modern language in many respects. It's not a language that was sort of developed with the hindsight of 20 or 30 years of software engineering experience. It's a fairly antiquated language. It's useful, very incredibly useful. Not saying it's not useful, very useful. But things like separate header files from your implementation files and having to declare things in two places, just little sort of annoying things that sort of show its age, they add up. Your project gets bigger and bigger, and now you're into a million lines of code. Now you're into 10 million lines of code. Now you're into 100 million lines of code, and the little things that were minor inconveniences are now huge problems in such a large code base. And this is important because I'm not getting any faster as time goes on. My computer keeps getting faster. This does not keep getting faster, though. If anything, it's getting slower. So programmers don't get faster, so our tools have to get better. And we've seen this. IDEs have gotten vastly better over the years. We have all kinds of amazing code completion, IntelliSense, class browsers, you know, all you name it, all sorts of amazing debugging facilities. That's great. But I want to bring up the idea that your tools don't stop at your IDE. Your tools are not just your IDE. Your language that you're using should be counted in your toolbox. That's one of your tools. Okay. If anyone says, no, you're wrong, we can have that debate. I don't mind. So I'm going to start with this premise that everyone shoots their eye out at some point. Okay. And what I mean by shooting your eye out, I mean someone's going to do something very wrong. You're going to implement the hairy mess that's like, oh my God, what was I thinking? You will do it at some point. I can almost guarantee it, of any non-trivial project. It doesn't have to be a hairy, hairy mess, but you will write yourself into a corner at some point, or you'll implement something that causes problems down the line. You're going to shoot your eye out. Okay. So there's a couple ways that people react to this realization that they're going to shoot their eye out. The first one is, well, we can just stop. We can just not shoot our eye out, you know? We're going to go to great lengths to just completely prevent this idea of backing ourselves into a corner. We're going to go away, and we're going to design the perfect architecture, okay? And we're just going to work it all out. We're going to get the team of senior architects together, and we're just going to do this thing right. And 3 years later, we're going to write our first line of code and find out that it actually doesn't cover all the cases that we thought it covered. So we've tried waterfall as an industry. It doesn't work. I think it's pretty obvious at this point. It doesn't work. The games industry, though, not really on board with that. I still see a lot of waterfall going on. So that's one idea. Some people, this is the guy right out of college. He's making his MMO. It's going to take down World of Warcraft. He's doing it by himself, but that's okay, you know. He's just in there, and he's not aware that he's completely ruining his architecture. He's just barreling through that, completely oblivious, until it blows up in his face. And you've got the people who, this is the most amazing group to my mind. They just don't care. You say, that code, it's kind of clunky that you got to do this and this and this just to get this one thing done. And they're like, oh, yeah, but whatever. Numb to the pain, I guess, after years of doing it. They just don't care. And that I think this is the most dangerous, because if you're aware of it and you don't do anything about it, then you're just going to perpetuate that problem forever. Okay, and then you got your fourth group. This is a group we hope that we are in. We're aware that there's danger. We know we're probably going to shoot our eye out at some point, but it's going to be a majored risk. We're probably going to screw up, but hey, we're going to keep going, and we're going to take a majored response to when things go horribly wrong. Okay, so if we're going to make our mistakes eventually, we might as well have a really nice gun. Might as well build this awesome gun while we're doing it, okay? So we're going to have some fun while we shoot our eye out. And to me, this means a good API. This is really about designing a really good API. That's my gun. That's my tool. It's my weapon for conquering complexity. So our API, like I was saying earlier, it doesn't start at just like the libraries you use. It starts at the language level, because the language informs the API that you can develop and shapes it and molds it. And certain APIs can only live in certain languages and vice versa. So which language should we use? C++. Don't use C++, please. If you're doing your high-level game logic, please do not use C++. And while you're at it, don't use C. And while we're on this path, don't use Java or C# either, okay? That's not going to work, because what about the speed, right? We're focused on speed, execution efficiency. It's got to run fast. We're not going to be implementing this thing in, you know, Python and have it run millions of polygons through at 60 frames per second. Just not fast enough. So, okay, I recognize. At some point, you're going to hit C and C++. If nothing else other than your DirectX or OpenGL driver layer, at some point, you're hitting C and C++. You're hitting the operating system at some point, right? So C and C++ are in there. The point is, it's not C++ that we've written. It's C++ that someone else has written, okay? And it's not our game logic. It's things like the heavy lifting. It's the rendering, your sort ordering, all these various things that can be done very quickly and fairly simply in a low-level language. So game logic is what we're interested in, this guy right here. And I'm just going to throw this out here, agree or disagree. I think game logic follows the 80-20 rule, as many things do. Not quite exactly the 80-20 rule, but in the general ballpark of the 80-20 rule, you got 20% of your processing time makes a lot of the decisions about your game. You've got a lot of things that are going on that take very small amounts of time. So here's our example. You got an AI character. Should he move towards the character or should he jump? You got like a little side scroller kind of game. Pretty simple decision when you come down to it mathematically. Okay, and then you've got this other situation. You need to z-sort a million polygons. Okay, well, which one of those has more impact on the game, do you think? Z-sorting or the AI character actually like doing the right thing? Z-sort wrong and you get, you know, things on top of other things. You get weird sort of graphical effects. Boxes look like they're inside out, that kind of thing. Probably not great. I'm not saying that's a good thing to go wrong. But compared to the AI character walking in the wrong direction, the cutscene not triggering, you know, some sort of spell or effect not going off properly and just, or doing the inverse, doing the exactly wrong thing, those are huge. Those are gameplay killers in some cases, especially with like a cutscene or trigger. Okay, I walked in the room. Nothing happens. And I'm stuck. Exit the game. Reload. Sigh. You know, hopefully there is a checkpoint and I can actually kill myself so I can get back to the checkpoint. So, very small amounts. Probably, I would actually say, probably even 5 or 10% of your processing time, depending on the game. You know, more towards, this is like the tech demo side. This is like, you know, Doom 3. And then this, you know, this is more in the middle. Very small amount of processing time making most of the decisions, most of the important things, the things that make your game a game, the thing that makes your game worth playing and interesting, are being done by a very small amount of the processor utilization. Okay, so this is a problem with this 5, 10, 20%, whatever it ends up being in your game, this game logic, because there's tons of code paths, very complicated. So we need a language that makes complicated stuff easier. Not easy, because you can never actually make complicated stuff just go away. You can only like reduce it and break it into chunks. We want it to be easier. So that's our goal. Now, if you don't believe me, it's fine. I accept that. But I do have a question. What is the game logic for World of Warcraft written in? Use the C++. Totally C++. C? Java? C#? Then what? What was it written in? It was written in Lua, which you may not have heard of, kind of a niche language to the games industry. It's a little embeddable language designed to be embedded in C and C++ applications. It's got a runtime of like 100K when it's loaded. It's tiny. So they use Lua, and that drives their C++ layer. They got this great graphics engine, all sorts of game logic, and then they bind it all together and glue it together with Lua. What about EVE Online or Battlefield 2? That's totally C++. Come on. I played those games. No? Lua? No. That actually is Python. Both those games use Python to do their scripting engines. Yep. You don't hear about this ever. It's amazing. Like, you would think that'd be like front page news in the game development industry, but whatever. We use Python. What about Unreal-based games? Has anyone ever messed with the Unreal editor? You actually, at this point, they've been taking away the ability to even call C++ or write your own C++. They're like sandboxing you now. You actually have to use like the Unreal script. So you have to be in their language, which is, you know, their high-level language. Now, they wrote it themselves, which I'm never really a fan of because you're not going to do it right compared to a general-purpose language. But they did create a high-level language for you, at least. They're not saying, like, here's the API. It's C++. Have fun with that. So all these large, commercial, viable games done all their game logic in a high-level language. So I'm not just completely blowing smoke out my ass. There's a little credibility to what I'm saying. So this isn't a completely new idea. You probably find examples of this going fairly far back. People have been inventing little scripting languages in their games for a long time. But this is the interesting distinction. Most of those systems end at adding a high-level language. Like that's the accomplishment. That's the end of the road right there. They're just a C wrapper or C++ wrapper. They're just a Lua method that you can call using Lua syntax that directly calls the C++ method, just a one-to-one type thing. So when you're writing code, gosh, it feels a lot like C++ still, because it is a C++ API, just wrapped up in the semantics of Lua or Python. Now, you could do cool, you know, iteration, list comprehension, data structure type stuff in Lua or Python or Perl or whatever language it is that you've got in there, but the API still feels like C++ and is limited by what C++ can do. Okay, so that's my distinction on what we're talking about here. So in my mind, this is like giving a Marine a Nerf rifle. You can put it together with this in a blindfold in 10 seconds, and then he can shoot you with it and do no damage. So you got this awesome killing machine that is completely and utterly nerfed by his weapon. Like, yay, awesome. Another analogy might be, that I couldn't find a good picture of, is like, you know, bicycle wheels or, you know, tricycle wheels on a race car. You know, you got this awesome engine. It can spin that axle so fast, and the wheels can't take it, and therefore you can go 5 miles an hour. So we want to be able to unleash the full language of our language, the full power of our language. Sorry. So we start with the API, and what we want is we want an API that just completely ignores all those silly, trivial things like reality about what our actual underlying API looks like, and we're just going to build our API. We'll build the API that Lua wants us to have, that Python wants us to have, whatever. So I'm going to give two examples of that today. There's projects I've worked on, Railgun, which is game engine, and Monkey Bars. So first off with Railgun, high-level language written in Ruby. I'm primarily a Ruby developer. And this was motivated by my utter frustration in that game development was too hard, and thus my time spent doing game development. There's a lot of time spent in game development, and not a lot came out of it, and I'm doing lots of projects, and I don't have time to do everything I want to. So we're going to build that better mousetrap. We're going to build that better game engine. It's not built from the ground up because I'm not insane, and I don't want to do heavy 3D math engine development. I want to do game development, not engine development. I see a very clear distinction there between those things. A lot of people start off, and they're going to build their game, which also happens to include an engine. And then 2 years later, they're ready to, you know, actually start writing a line of code of their game now that their engine can show stuff on the screen. So I use Jamie. It's Java-based game engine. These guys are employed at NCSoft these days, writing Java-based games for NCSoft. Very nice engine, very good example of a Java library. Very nice, clean Java library. And it itself uses OpenGL under the hood. So, I'm sorry, real quick. I'm here. I'm using JRuby, which is a implementation of Ruby that runs on top of Java. So I can do everything that Java can do from Ruby. Yes? The question was, am I doing that for performance reasons? Yes and no. I'm using JME because I don't want to do all that work. And then secondarily, the benefit is it runs fast. So I'm not doing, if I was a purely Ruby-based, say again? The question was, is JME using JRuby? I'm using JRuby to get at JME. So JME is a Java library, and I need a way for my Ruby code to call into that Java library. So that's what JRuby does. It's a bridge as well as an implementation of Ruby with inside Java. And I do a bunch of stuff you probably haven't seen in game development. At least I hope. Hope we're cutting forging new ground. So basic architecture, this isn't a talk about Railgun, like let me pimp my framework. This is just about some ideas about API development. So we're just going to give a quick overview of Railgun. It's MVC-ish. MVC gets thrown around a lot, and everyone's got their own idea of what MVC is. So here's my idea of what MVC is in the game world. I've got a state. That's my controller. I've got a bunch of entities. Those are my models. Why don't I call it model? Because in the game development world, model is a 3D mesh, and we found that it was impossible. Model? Well, are you talking about the mesh model or a model model? Like, we're renaming this right now. So we call them entities, which worked out pretty good in our metaphor. And then every entity has one or more views. And the view is the thing responsible for basically keeping track of the mesh. That's where the model comes in. The mesh, the particle system, the pixel shader effect, whatever it is, that lives on the view. So state has a bunch of entities. Each entity has one or more views. Okay. The big thing that we're doing here, and this is mostly informed slash borrowed slash stolen from the other big Ruby frameworks such as Rails and that sort of thing, is a declarative style. I really like this, and it's fairly common in the Ruby community, a declarative style. So in your view, you don't say, you, view, go load this model. View, attach thyself to this node. View, do this. You say, the model to be used with this view is such and such. Okay, so it's declarative. It does the same thing. Under the hood, the same things are happening, but it's a different style. And it makes probably more of a difference than you might think when first exposed to the idea. So here's an example. I got a demo view, inherits from Railgun model view, which is like the base view. And in my load method that gets run automatically when it's instantiated, I simply say the model is test model 04. Okay, that's it. And okay, you say, that's great. We can implement that in Java. I mean, come on. We have a load method. It takes the name of the thing to load, and then we can say load test model 04. Ha ha! Gotcha. I will grant that. I'll grant that. The problem here is, though, we need options, right? What if the model is the wrong size? Or you're using Max, and it's got a different concept of what axis should be up than Maya and the rest of the world, and so you have to like rotate it 90 degrees across a certain axis to get it to show up right in your game engine. So you need options. And having only a single parameter does not give us that. And this is why, of course, the Java API is broken into a bunch of methods to begin with. So you can do things like load it, and then you can translate it, and then you can do all these various things. Well, the reality of the situation is our model method actually takes two parameters. Even though we used it like this, it actually takes two parameters. For anyone who actually uses Ruby or something like that, you're like, duh. Bear with me that this may be slightly an interesting concept for people using Java. So, second parameter is optional. So that means we can omit it, and it will get filled in with that value over there, that squiggly line, the curly brace, that just means empty hash. A hash in Ruby is a map, hash map implementation. So we can omit any sort of parameters that we don't want. Okay, so we can add in, we've got our model, we've got test model, and then our first like quasi-parameter is a implicit hash, so it's as if we had put the hash markers around it. It's an implicit hash, so we're passing two things here, test model and the hash that contains the key rotation and the value and array 0, 0, -5. And the nice thing is we can add more of these because it's a hash, right? So you can have as many keys as you want. So we can add scale and translation and or whichever ones we want. We could have just scale, just translation, all three of them, two of them, whatever, mix and match. And that they look like parameters, even though formally we've only declared that we have two parameters to our method. Okay, of course, this could lead to us shooting our eye out. The most common thing that jumps to mind is you typo the hash key, and then you're like, why isn't it doing what I want to do? And you stare at it for hours and hours or days and days, and you're like, oh yeah, okay, so I typed, you know, scale with an O instead of a C or something, whatever. Some silly, trivial thing that's very difficult to actually see because you've read it a million times, and you just gloss over it. Well, we can handle that. So like we said, we have a measured response to our shooting our eye out, okay? So we're like, hey, probably going to shoot our eye out right here. Now we're going to put on the armor. Not like full-blown, you know, SWAT gear armor. We're not going to go crazy. Just, you know, put on shooting glasses. You know. Just going to handle this one thing. So what we have is we have this addition to hash. We add in some methods to hash called some validations. So validate only. So we just validate. You hand us this hash, we validate. You've only given us scale, translation, and rotation. There we go. It's safe now. I'm not going to validate the data you pass in, of course, because